Welcome to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is the sound of a dream coming true.
She got silver.
On Saturday, 24-year-old Michaela Skinner won the Olympic silver medal on vault. And Skinner's win was utterly unexpected. An alternate on the 2016 Olympic team and a non-participant in this year's team competition, Skinner just missed earning a place in the individual apparatus competition for vault. But after Simone Biles stepped aside, Skinner canceled her flight back to Utah, got herself back to the Olympic gym, and won silver 2 days later. It's the kind of comeback story we all love. And her win is extraordinary for another reason. Just over 6 months ago, Michaela Skinner was diagnosed with COVID-19.
I was sick for a whole 2 weeks, and then I was like starting to feel better. And then after those 2 weeks, I like kind of thought I was getting better. Things were going good. I went into the gym 3 different times, was super weak. It was really, really hard. And then on a Sunday after that, I got really sick, went to the hospital, and found out I had pneumonia.
That Michaela Skinner could go from a hospital bed to the Olympic medal stand in less than a year is undoubtedly a testament to her exceptional respiratory conditioning as an elite athlete. And maybe we can credit a bit of Olympic fairy dust as well. But for many who contract COVID-19, the debilitating reality of living with COVID's lingering symptoms is a very different story. Chronic pain, lasting heart problems, powerful fatigue, thick brain fog. These are just some of the long-term symptoms that persist for many COVID long haulers months after the initial diagnosis of the illness. And of course, we don't know what the effects of the illness may be years or even decades from now for the millions who continue to struggle with COVID's after effects. Last week, on the 31st anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Biden administration released guidance explaining that long COVID can now be classified as a disability under the ADA.
These conditions can sometimes rise to the level of a disability. So we're bringing agencies together to make sure Americans with long COVID who have a disability have access to the rights and resources that are due under the disability law.
So even as we celebrate Michaela Skinner's tremendous athletic performance, we must face the reality that for millions, simply making it through the day with the lasting effects of COVID feels like an Olympic feat. With me now to talk more about the guidance on long COVID as a disability is Georgia Linders, a COVID long hauler. Welcome, Georgia.
Thank you.
And Eve Hill, a disability rights attorney at Brown, Goldstein & Levy and former deputy assistant attorney of the U.S. Department of Justice Civil Rights Division. Welcome to the show, Eve.
Thank you for having me.
Georgia, just so our audience understands, how long have you been sick?
I have been sick for about a year and a half. So I got sick during the first wave in March 2020.
And talk us through a little bit of sort of the arc of that illness, what it looked like at the beginning and what your experiences and symptoms are now.
Sure. What you were talking about before, about all of the people and even the Olympic gal, I feel like that could have been my story also because my experience was very similar. I got sick. Yeah. March, April of 2020. I was really sick for like 2 or 3 weeks and then got better. And then got worse and then got better. And it continued like that the rest of the year. My main symptoms were fever. I had a low fever for every single day. And then every once in a while, it would spike up to over 100. And then that's when it would really affect my mood. So during that time, there were times where I actually felt a lot better. And I thought it was going to be over and done. And then I'd get and then we'd come back. I ended up finding support groups online. And because, you know, doctors didn't really know anything, I couldn't get a test in the beginning. There were tiers for who could get a test and who couldn't, and I didn't qualify. So the health department and the hospital both told me to just stay home and assume that I have it.
Georgia, thank you so much. And I'm going to come back to you in just a moment. Eve, can you tell us a little bit about this guidance that was issued by the White House last week and what it means for folks like Georgia?
Sure. The Departments of Justice, Health and Human Services, Education and Labor all got together to issue this guidance that says under the ADA Title II and Title III, under Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act and Section 1557 of the Affordable Care Act, long COVID can be a disability. And this was important guidance because there have been a lot of questions about whether long COVID could be a disability. Now, the guidance doesn't say COVID is always a disability, but it is a disability if it meets the definition under those laws, which is that the person has a physical or mental impairment that substantially impairs a major life activity. And long COVID can impair a major life activity in a lot of ways. The things Georgia has described, the things the Olympian has described, lung function, heart function, kidney function, all those can be major impairments. And the CDC has said that long COVID is an impairment. So you just have to look at whether the person has a substantial limitation of a major life activity. And if they do, they're covered under the federal civil rights laws.
And Eve, what does that mean to say they're covered under the federal civil rights laws? What protections does that offer?
It offers a variety of protections. They can't be excluded from public accommodations, which are most of the businesses that we deal with. So you can't exclude a person with long COVID from recreation programs or restaurants and businesses, and also from state and government, state and local government or federally funded activities, programs and services like schools, licensing programs, healthcare services, and so forth. Also, it means that they can be entitled to reasonable accommodations or reasonable modifications. So, for example, the ability to sit while waiting in line, extra time on tests for a person with brain fog due to long COVID, or the ability to minimize walking distance. All those kinds of things are available because they can be covered under the ADA and the other laws.
Georgia, what are the major life activities that have been affected for you by your long COVID?
Well, when you guys are talking about that just now, I'm really, really going to try not to cry. this announcement and everything was really validating, but it's about a year too short almost for me because I already actually lost my job. I had been working for 10 years at a company, and I was fighting through the times when I'd feel better than worse. When it was worse, I had, you know, there's 20 different symptoms that I had, but I, and this is one of my main symptoms, like right now my brain is slowing down. Mm-hmm. So I have to pretty much do like one thing at a time. It's hard for me to do multitasking. And I have, since then I have had neurocognitive testing, and I do have a mild neurocognitive disorder. And so that's why the issues that I have mainly are, fatigue. And it's delayed fatigue. So like I could go to the grocery store today, but then tomorrow I'll feel horrible. And I pretty much am at home almost all the time. I don't go anywhere. And then I can barely take a shower. That's my, like once a week, I have a goal to take a shower and I have to use a shower chair. I have to sit down in the shower. And so it's been really difficult because I was really active before. I was not an Olympian, mm-hmm. but I had lost a lot of weight and I was at like the healthiest I'd ever been. I worked full time. I did wedding hair on the side part time, and I had like flowers outside that I'd garden. And, you know, I found ways of being active without like working out. I could never do that, but I found ways to enjoy exercise. But I could tell right when I got sick, and then the few months after, kind of like last summer, I couldn't do any of those things. I just pretty much had to sit on the couch all day.
Eve, it breaks my heart not only to hear Georgia talk about how dramatically her life has changed as a result of long COVID, but Eve, it's also very concerning to me that she's saying it feels like this ADA protection is too late. What does this protection offer for long haulers like Georgia who may have already
lost their jobs, lost so many of the activities that they loved and that gave meaning to their lives.
Well, hopefully it gives them hope of going on. I understand that things are terrible in the moment, but as things get better, which we hope that they do, they will have protections as they return to the workplace, as they return to government service, as they return to participating in all the things that they enjoy in life and that are open to them in life. It is a problem that the guidance is late, but the law has actually said this the whole time. This is not a change in the law. The law has applied this whole time, as long as people meet the definition. But there are some difficulties that remain. Some people with long COVID got it before testing, as Georgia did. The testing wasn't available, so may have difficulty getting a diagnosis. That's still a barrier. But we remind people that you don't have to have a specific causal diagnosis. It doesn't have to say it's long COVID. It just has to say there's a neurological dysfunction, that there's shortness of breath. That's a sufficient diagnosis to be covered under the ADA.
Maybe you're a graduate student and you're going to need extra time on tests, or maybe you're going back for job training. How do you sort of access these protections?
Most entities should have processes for requesting accommodations. And so if you're returning to school, you go to your Office of Disability Services and ask them for the accommodations you need. If you're going to a government agency, you go to them and ask them for who do I talk to about reasonable accommodations. It should be a fairly simple process of identifying your diagnosis, telling them what you need, and going through an interactive process with them to make sure that what you need can be done in the context of the program that you're acting in. But there are lots and lots of accommodations. Almost anything can be an accommodation if it's necessary for the person to participate in the program. So things like, a lot of people with long COVID suffer shortness of breath. So asking for the ability to sit, more breaks, reduced walk distances, all those are accommodations that people can ask for. And a lot of people with long COVID suffer what we call brain fog. And accommodations for that include extra breaks, extended time, and memory aids that will help you do what you need to do to participate in the program. So there are lots and lots of things that can be open to accommodate people with long COVID. And don't feel constrained by the examples that I gave, or the examples in the federal guidance, or even what you've heard from people in your support groups. You can get what you need.
So Georgia, I think maybe you particularly got to me when you talked about gardening. I'm a backyard gardener and farmer. The idea of losing the stamina to do that, I really feel that loss. But you've also become something else in this process. You've become a bit of an activist. Can you talk about that a little?
Sure. So I started getting involved with the support groups in the, I think the summer, fall of last year. But I didn't actually start, volunteering for things until after I had stopped working. And that was November of last year. So there's two things. I started making dolls, and because it's all that I could do, like sitting down on the couch. And there are a couple organizations. At that time, right when I stopped working, I was diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome. And so that opened up a lot of resources. And I became an advocate with a couple different ones. There's something called the Long COVID Alliance, which is a whole bunch of nonprofits all getting together from the ME/CFS community and long COVID community. And I participated in Advocacy Day this past April. So not last year, this year, April, where we talked to Congress people about being a long hauler and that we're here and we need help. And so even though I was going through, this horrible illness, I took all the energy that was put into working. And this is something that has been really fulfilling to me.
Eve, can you talk about your work with the Stop the Wait Coalition?
Sure. One of the things that remains undecided is how long COVID will be treated for disability-related benefits like Social Security disability insurance. And one of the things that I'm working on with the Stop the Wait Coalition is eliminating the 5-month wait period for Social Security disability insurance. People who develop disabilities and can no longer work go on Social Security disability insurance, and the government keeps the first 5 months of your benefits. So even though we all pay in to Social Security disability through every paycheck, the first 5 months are free, basically, not for the person with a disability, but for the government. And we're trying to get rid of that 5-month wait period so people can get the benefits that they deserve from the beginning. When they need the money, they can get the money to help deal with healthcare, home modifications, keeping their home, and so forth during this very difficult time.
Oh, that I feel like that's one of those aspects of law and of our social safety net that unless you are actively accessing it, you just didn't even know about that 5 months.
That's exactly right. Nobody knows until it happens to them. And that's the worst time to both be denied those benefits and to find out that this quirk in the law exists.
Georgia, I'm wondering, for you as a long hauler, and particularly as someone who got COVID before you could even get a test, before we had strong, clear guidance about masking and distancing, I'm wondering what message you want to send to others in the wake of these rising COVID numbers across the country.
That is a good question. Being a COVID long hauler, it's still a very small amount of the people that become as bad as I am, because I'm applying for SSDI right now. I'm in the process. A lot of people sometimes will just have, you know, a few symptoms and they're not quite sure, and then they end up getting better. But there's a group of us that have been sick for like a year and a half and we're still sick. Most people don't. It's kind of like they say, most people don't die. Most people don't get as sick as I am, but it could happen to anyone. So, and it's, my life was completely different before I got sick versus after I got sick. Even though I couldn't get a test, I still knew what it was. And that, I know that's been a big part of all the advocacy, where a lot of people couldn't get tests. So then they're like, oh my gosh, some of them, they won't even let into the post-COVID clinics if they didn't have a positive test. So that's been really tricky, but they really worked with the CDC, advocacy groups did, and the White House about that fact. So hopefully, it's kind of like Social Security. They told me when I was applying, because I'm on long-term disability from my employer, even though I don't work there anymore, I was on short-term disability and then long-term because they offered it and I just had to prove that I couldn't work. It didn't matter how I got sick or why I got sick. It was just, hey, there's something wrong with my brain, you know? So it's kind of the same thing with, there was a meeting, the president talked about it, and then we had a short meeting yesterday where they kind of explained more of the benefits of what we're talking about right now. And see, there I go. I lost my thought again. So my brain slows down and I forget what I'm talking about like halfway through. So, man, yeah, I lost it.
It's okay, Georgia. What I want you to know for certain is that the strength of your intellect, of your kindness, of your advocacy, and also the reality of your suffering is all coming through in this moment. And we're so appreciative that you took the time to join us. Georgia Linders is a COVID long hauler, and Eve Hill is a disability rights attorney at Brown, Goldstein, and Levy, and former Deputy Assistant Attorney General of the U.S. Department of Justice Civil Rights Division. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and you're listening to The Takeaway. On August 1, there were at least 79,000 reported cases of COVID-19 in the U.S. The number is well below the more than a quarter million cases reported at the pandemic's height back in January, but it's a significant and troubling increase. These are the kinds of case numbers we hoped were behind us forever after vaccines became widely available. And in many ways, the most distressing days are a thing of the past for the fully vaccinated. The overwhelming majority of serious cases are occurring among unvaccinated people. Major private sector employers are therefore taking a step many had long resisted, requiring the COVID-19 vaccine for certain groups of employees. Facebook, Google, Walmart, Disney all announced last week that at least some of their employees will need to get vaccinated. Disney is still in the process of negotiating a vaccination requirement for its union employees, but Walmart has held off on requiring its store and warehouse workers to get vaccinated. And that's despite the fact that lower wage workers are less likely to have received the vaccine. As workers navigate this patchwork of requirements, we wanted to hear from you on this. Is your employer currently implementing a vaccine requirement or mask mandate? And how do you feel about it?
Hi, this is Judy in Walnut Creek, California. My company does not require vaccination, but we must report to HR our vaccination status or we can decline to state. If one declines to state, one has to follow protocols for unvaccinated staff, which includes masking while indoors, unless you can be in a room by yourself with the door closed. Everyone working in the office is now required to wear a mask while working indoors.
Hey, it's Alejandro from Denton. My workplace recently instituted a mask mandate again, but it does not have a vaccine requirement. However, the mask mandate makes me feel a lot more secure, and it also gives me the freedom to call people out for not wearing a mask because the policy backs me up.
Hi, I'm Dan from Southwest Arkansas. I am a school administrator, and no, we cannot have a mask mandate because our legislators have passed a law that prohibits us from making the local decisions for our schools in terms of mask mandates for teachers or students.
Hi, my name's Bonnie. I'm calling from Parker, Colorado. And as a teacher going back to work this week and students returning next week, I'm very concerned that there's no vaccine or mask mandate. With the CDC recommending masking with the Delta variant, I will be masking and wish that everybody was required to do so.
This is Charlie calling from Edmonds, Washington, and I am the owner-operator of a small remodeling firm. Vaccination is required for anybody on our job site. That's our choice. And with the Delta variant making its astounding appearance, we insist on masks everywhere inside. And if the home is occupied during the work, most of my customers would insist on masks anyway and have for the last year and a half.
This is Anna calling from Staten Island. I work for a small business that's had a mask mandate in place since we reopened in June of 2020. And we never lifted it when the CDC relaxed their guidelines because it was never clear who was going to be responsible if somebody unvaccinated came to work and got seriously ill. Is it the company's responsibility or would it be the unvaccinated individuals? And I'm just kind of dumbfounded, actually, that almost half of the workforce in my company is still unvaccinated, and we're still accommodating them just the way we did before the vaccines were even available.
Hello, my name's Nicole. I'm calling from Texas. My employer was threatening to fire people if they let others know about their exposure to COVID after a positive test. They don't even allow us to say anything to customers that come in the door if they're not wearing a mask. And if customers want to chastise us for wearing a mask, that's perfectly acceptable too. This is a very well-known large company, and I fear for my safety due to their lack of precautions.
A growing number of major businesses are in the process of rolling out vaccine requirements. but some of these requirements only apply to groups of employees that are already much more likely to be vaccinated. For more on these policies, I'm joined by Lauren Hirsch, reporter for the New York Times, who focuses on business and policy. Lauren, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So you mentioned in your recent reporting that the Equal Opportunity Employment Commission has said twice since last December that employers can require their employees to get vaccinated. So why are we only seeing these requirements sort of emerging now?
It's a great question. You know, employers have wanted to, many have wanted to vaccinate their workforce for over a year now, but they've really been worried about litigation. There's some precedent, but not a lot, and the vaccines don't yet have full FDA approval. And there's also been a lot of concern around the political aspects of it. Will employees revolt? Will they push back? Will they quit en masse? And companies don't really like to be the first mover on a whole lot of things. But what has happened over the past several months is the Delta variant. So employers realize this, unfortunately, does not seem to be going away anytime soon. And in fact, there are new questions that they'll have to answer. There have been some legal rulings around the issue, including a hospital that had mandated vaccines for its employees. They sued, and the court overthrew that suit. And three, we've seen a number of governments institute their own mandates. And so that really provides cover for the companies. Employers kind of reached the point where they decided there were enough forces and it was time, and they felt a little bit more comfortable instituting a mandate now, whereas they were afraid to even a month or so ago.
It feels very topsy-turvy to me, because I genuinely remember as recently as a year ago that the question was, when are we going to have access? And that the policies initially were, you know, how to kind of keep a run on vaccines from happening by rolling them out slowly. What has happened over the course of that year to shift this so dramatically?
What has happened is there's really been this divide in the country over who has been vaccinated and who has not. And it's fallen along economic lines. It's fallen along racial lines. And so companies need to deal with that issue. There's some who would never go back to the office if they were not fully vaccinated, and would never go back if their coworkers were fully vaccinated. And there are others who don't want to get vaccinated. And many companies employ both sets, which is a little bit why we're beginning to see another issue that has emerged really even over the past couple of weeks, which is different mandates for different kinds of workforces, because they have to manage that a bit. So it's this very complicated issue. And then you get to the point of, you know, what does the CEO want? The CEO, by and large, wants his or her workforce to be safe and healthy and not worry about an outbreak. And so for them, they would vastly prefer having the entire workforce vaccinated. But the rollout just didn't reach as broad of a breadth as people had hoped, or certainly as quickly as it hoped. And so therefore, employers seem to now deal with the irregularities under which it essentially rolled out.
It feels like those that are not requiring vaccines are also not requiring masks, which seems like it should be the inverse.
I would say it's not kind of quite that clear. You know, there's a number of retailers that when the new CDC guidelines came out, they said you have to wear masks regardless of whether or not you're vaccinated. Publix, Kroger, Target, and those companies are not yet mandating vaccines. It just raises like a whole other issue, because if you're requiring masks and you're depending on whether or not they're vaccinated, then how are you deciding or confirming whether or not they're vaccinated? How do you bring people back into the office and make them wear masks when you're telling them it's safe, but the idea of wearing masks gives you the feeling that it's not safe? In some ways, you know, requiring a mask is easier than requiring a vaccine, because there's less fear around litigation. But in other ways, it's harder, because it really makes the hours in which you're working less enjoyable. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't really get you to the place of norm that so many employers want to get to.
What are some of the patterns that we're seeing, particularly across these large businesses, the Walmarts, the Disneys, between maybe what we might call the professional salaried class and then those who are maybe working hourly wages and maybe don't have white collar workers versus the more blue and pink collar workers within a single large company?
It's a great question. So Walmart is a great example of it. They are mandating vaccines for its corporate workforce, those in its headquarters. It is not mandating it for those in its stores. And so Walmart won't say why the difference, but a pretty safe bet is the fact that there's a labor shortage right now. And a lot of retailers are just having a hard time hiring. They're having a hard time keeping workers. And once you get into this vaccine mandate situation, one does need to worry about whether or not you're going to lose workers. And a lot of Walmart stores are in areas where the population tends, you know, is less vaccinated than in other parts of the country. Morgan Stanley, the investment bank, is mandating vaccines in its New York offices for employees and those who are visiting. But that's only for its New York offices. And it only did it when it was 90% vaccinated. And so a really big question is whether or not companies will be comfortable or willing to extend these mandates when their workforce is significantly less vaccinated. And you mentioned Disney. So there right now, they have mandated vaccines, but they are negotiating the issue with its union. So right now, its union workers are excluded from that mandate. And unions as a whole are not really all following along the same lines as to how they view the issue. Some are supportive of mandates, some are less supportive. And that's in part a reflection of the people that make up their groups. And it's something that I and many others are really watching over the next couple of months, because the industries with unions, the industries with labor shortages are, you know, tend to be the industries that are most exposed to the virus. And so what is the political appetite for imposing it? And how far ultimately will these mandates go if we're limited by those factors?
Help me understand maybe the legal framework or basis here. Again, working on college campuses, we have required vaccines of all kinds for as long as I've been a professor and a student, so 35 years or something. There were all kinds of different vaccines that you had to have in order to work and live and learn on campus. And I'm thinking about circumstances for many folks in the workforce where they're subjected to random drug testing, for example. Why is this somehow so different?
A couple of reasons. One is schools are great. And education is a great reference point, and many people have pointed to it. There's Supreme Court rulings saying that educational institutions can require vaccines, but it's not a one-to-one when you think about a private employer, so it's not a perfect comparison. Another issue is the fact that while the vaccines have emergency authorization, they don't have full FDA approval, and that has made, you know, a number of employers, at least until the past couple of weeks, nervous about the mandates. And you even have states trying to pass laws that say you can't mandate vaccines for anyone that aren't fully FDA approved. And so, you know, simply targeting the COVID vaccine itself. And of course, backdrop against all of this is how politically charged the entire debate and issue has been. So all of a sudden, something that's a health issue has also taken on political overtones. And that's an area that employers hate being in, but have thrust in. But to your earlier point, yes, it is, you know, the EEOC said twice, first in December, then followed up to say employers may require this, but it is untested in terms of an employer requiring a vaccine. There's always the threat of lawsuits. And it's been described to me, of course, they'll be just sued. Whether or not they'll be, whether or not those lawsuits will be victorious is a different question. And so far, we've already seen one lawsuit over the issue being thrown out. But no employer likes to be, you know, likes to deal with litigation, likes to deal with those headlines. And so that has been top of the list of their concerns.
It certainly feels like being sued is just true, big capital T, whether you require vaccines or not, right? It just kind of depends on whether you're sued for requiring them or sued for not requiring them.
Exactly. Exactly. Absolutely. Yes.
When you talk about the current retail labor shortage, have you talked with workers? Have they described a reluctance to return to work because of vaccines, or a reluctance to return to work because vaccines are being required?
It's a great question. You know, we're only beginning to see where, you know, how workers will respond to these mandates. You know, retail, many of those workers have been in the front lines since right the beginning for most of the pandemic. So in many ways, a vaccine would protect, you know, a fully vaccinated workforce and customer base would protect them. But not everyone is going to want to be vaccinated, as we have seen. So that is what makes it so complicated. And in terms of going back into the office, you know, we, in one of our stories that we covered on this issue, we spoke about an Apple employee who basically said to us, you know, why would I want to go back to the office if they're not going to mandate vaccines? You're telling me it's not safe and I have to do it. And I've been productive in my, you know, in my home for a year and a half. So there's just so many layers and so many different views on this. But of course, the main concern should probably be the health and safety of everyone. But there's also management issues and HR issues that employers are thinking through.
Lauren Hirsch is a reporter for the New York Times who focuses on business and policy. Lauren, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Work, 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 work. You send me heavy work, 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 work. You see me do me dirt, 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 dirt.
And some of that work, 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 work. This is The Takeaway, and I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, grooving over here on the mic to Queen Rihanna, singing about work. Or really about all the good stuff that happens when the workday is finally over. But on this day, August 3rd, we're reminded that for Black women, work does not pay equally. August 3rd is Black Women Equal Pay Day. And no, it's not a celebration of us sisters securing our bags. It's a marker of just how much harder it is for us to stack our cash. Because Black women earn only 63 cents for every dollar earned by non-Hispanic white men, this means that on this day in 2021, Black women's average wages finally match the average wages of non-Hispanic white men from 2020. Yeah, it takes an average Black woman 19 months to earn what the average white man earns in 12. This is economics professor Michelle Holder discussing why.
The double gap means that Black women in the United States are in a labor market where they face wage penalties based on both their gender and their race.
Joining me now to discuss how this double gap shows up in the tech industry is Tarika Barrett, CEO of Girls Who Code. Welcome to The Takeaway, Tarika.
Thank you so much, Melissa. It's a pleasure to be here.
So how does this double gap show up in tech industries? Because don't Black women in computing-related jobs actually face a more narrow pay gap?
I want to start by saying we are still a far cry from pay parity, but instead of the 63 cents to the dollar that you just referenced in your introduction, Black women make a lot more in tech. It's actually 90 cents to the dollar. But the point that I want to underscore is that despite this, Black women hold only 3% of computing jobs in the US. And so it's a reminder of how far we still have to go before we achieve pay equity for Black women and other women of color.
Right. That makes perfect sense to me, right? That within the sort of narrower field of tech, the pay equity might not be as disparate. But given how, you know, what small percentages there are, that small percentage then leads to what that overall gap is in average workers' wages.
That's right. And I think that, listen, the 90 cents at its face sounds very promising. And certainly it's a reminder that we need to get more Black and brown women into tech. It's an improvement over 2019 when it was 87 cents to the dollar and 2016 when it was 79 cents. And we know that it's certainly better than the national average, but we have to recognize that it's still unacceptable nonetheless. But Black women continue to be locked out of the tech industry. And, you know, this matters because it means a lack of opportunity to some of the most highest paying jobs in our economy.
So talk to me a bit more about these sort of two aspects when you talk about this lockout from the industry. How much of it is about sort of driven by the workers themselves, by either lack of preparedness or lack of interest on the part of Black girls and women to go into these fields? And how much of it is about an industry that is not prepared to open itself to Black girls and women who want to be in these fields?
It is never about what's happening to our Black and brown girls and women. They're ready. They are eager. They're poised to take on these opportunities. I think what we have to hone in on is what's happening, you know, before they even get their foot in the door. So I'm talking about hiring practices and obsession around credentialing. And it's also about an inhospitable and unwelcoming culture that they encounter when they get there. What we find ourselves grappling with right now is continued reliance upon an elitist system of academic credentialing that offers a very narrow and privileged perspective of success. And so what is really appalling is that you have an industry that's not looking at these women who are the embodiment of bravery and resilience, qualities that these companies are desperate to have represented in their workforce. But when they're obsessed with conventional academic credentials that they rely on all the time, they miss this. And it's absolutely self-defeating because we know that computer science is one of the fastest growing professions in the country. We're talking about growth of 11% that will translate into 500,000 new jobs. So we can't afford to leave a single ounce of tech talent on the proverbial table. And so, Melissa, that gets at, you know, again, before these young women put their foot in the door, but what happens when they actually get there? We're still encountering a punishing work culture in tech rooted in systemic racism and sexism and discrimination that often alienates young women and especially young men of color when they get their first jobs.
Talk to me a little bit more about precisely that. Once you have the foot in the door, but the work of getting promoted, of moving to the next rung on the ladder.
We know based on research we've done with Accenture that 50% of women leave the tech industry before the age of 35. It's exactly what you're pointing to. It's things like parental leave policies. It's that they don't get promoted or don't see women who look like me in the senior ranks of leadership. Sometimes it's just a toxic corporate culture. And for Black women in particular, we know that it's also, you know, constant microaggressions that don't leave them feeling as though they can continue motivated to work in that industry. We know that creating a more welcoming environment would actually increase the number of women in tech by 3 million. That's what our recent study found.
Are there any models that are working right now, either, you know, partnerships between tech companies and HBCUs or places where we've seen the pay gap really narrow? Are there any sectors or companies or initiatives that seem to be working?
There are lots of seeds and there's some, you know, bright sparks here and there. I'll point to something that we have done recently. So, you know, Girls Who Code, we've been thinking about how to address these issues with companies, right? Because we are heavily corporate partner funded. We are doing this work so that our young women have opportunities with these companies. And we decided in this moment of the pandemic to launch this program called Work Prep, which introduces college age women to career pathways in tech. And we decided to do this with our partners. It's 2 weeks, it's virtual, it's flexible. It contemplates the barriers that women who are typically underrepresented encounter. So they're balancing responsibilities. And in terms of your question about promise and what we think is working, we had to have some of the most unvarnished direct conversations with our partners about something like GPA and credentialing, saying we don't want GPA to be an unnecessary barrier for these women. And, you know, what's great is that they heard it. And they also said, you know what, not only are we going to move this barrier away, we're going to think about other things that are credential based that are getting in the way of recruiting and bringing women, you know, into an opportunity where they get a chance to have an internship or their first job in tech. And I know it's not just us. I know folks over at NPower are doing phenomenal things in this space in terms of really pushing industry to think about how they have a huge role to play in changing this paradigm.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. Tarika Barrett, CEO of Girls Who Code. Thank you for joining The Takeaway.
Thank you so much again.
And speaking of giving folks their due, as we close out the program today, I'm going to speak the name of someone we here at The Takeaway, as well as the larger WNYC team in New York, are holding close in our hearts this week. That name is Temitayo Fegbenle. they were once a member of this production team as a young adult. After basically growing up at WNYC as an award-winning teenage reporter with Radio Rookies, the station's journalism mentorship program. Known around these parts as simply Temi, they made enormous contributions during their short time on this show and left an even bigger mark that can never be erased during their short time in this world. Temi passed away late last week at the age of 25. To get a better sense, here's a clip of Temi reporting for WNYC, this time on cyberbullying, and will help you understand why they were such a bright light in this profession.
I see girls get exposed on my Facebook news feed almost every day. It's just that now when we chastise each other, everybody that has access to the internet can see it. And once that picture or video is out, you can't be completely safe in your mind that the past won't creep up on you at some random time. This is the new Scarlet Letter.
It is now ordered that you shall wear upon your bosom for the rest of your natural life the Scarlet Letter A.
For WNYC, I'm rookie reporter Temitayo Fagbenle.
Boldly curious, unapologetically authentic to the bone, and able to make you laugh until it hurts, you still knew to always take them seriously. Temi, rest well. This takeaway is for you. Everyone else out there, thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and I'll meet you back here tomorrow.